my name is Jemima Steinfeld, and I run the Literature Festival at Asia House. Tonight we are doing an event as part of our Literature Festival, which is in collaboration with Waterstones and also with John Murray Publishers. For those of you who are unfamiliar, Asia House is the UK Centre of Expertise on Asia. Our mission is to bring Asia and the UK closer together, and we do this in a mixture of ways, including through our pioneering arts and learning events, such as the Asia House Bagri Foundation Literature Festival. It's a real highlight to be here, and we also have to extend our thanks to the Bagri Foundation, our title partner, and also to Alka Bagri, who's sitting here at the front. The Bagri Foundation is a UK-registered charity whose principal aims include the advancement of literature, education, and the arts. We are thrilled to host Amitav Ghosh tonight. Ghosh is one of the most accomplished writers today. He is a novelist with an extraordinary sense of history and place, which his latest work, Flood of Fire, exemplifies perfectly. Tonight, Ghosh is in conversation with Bhavit Mehta, Literature Programme Manager at the British Council. He will introduce Amitav Ghosh more fully. Join me in giving them a warm welcome.
Can you all hear me? That was good? Brilliant, excellent. Well, welcome. Apologies that we're starting a little bit later than the advertised time, but we're running on Indian time.
No, it's actually English time.
We thought it was 7:30, so we were having a cup of tea and talking about the event, so we do apologise for that.
Yes.
There's also a video is, I think, at some point going to be shown, but it may not. And if it doesn't, don't worry. We're enough to keep you entertained. But if it does, then brilliant. So I'm going to just very briefly introduce you to Amitav. I think most of you here know him, know his work, you've read his books. People are smiling like they have seen a superstar, which he is, of course. But nonetheless, it's my duty to introduce him so that those of you who don't perhaps know who are sitting amongst us can become familiar straight away. Amitav Ghosh, born in Calcutta, 1956. Brilliant. You studied in Dehradun, you studied in New Delhi, you studied in Alexandria, which is very strange, but we'll come back to that later, and at Oxford, brilliant, where you did your doctorate. You've written publications for The Hindu, for New Yorker, for Granta, and for several other publications and magazines. And you've taught at universities both in India and in the US. You've been awarded the Padma Shri by the Indian government in 2007. You're married to a writer called Deborah Baker, and you have two wonderful children. You divide your time between Kolkata, Goa, Brooklyn. Your
yes.
homes exist in these places. What's wrong with London?
I often ask myself, why I don't have a foothold here. I love London. I think it's a wonderful place. And I think especially for South Asians, London is really a very, very rewarding place to be. You know, there's so many people coming through. There's such a sort of rich South Asian cultural life here.
One day.
Oh, I don't think I could ever afford to live in London.
I hope one day you can afford to live in London. Great to have you amongst us. Great. Your first novel, which was written in 1986, The Circle of Reason, set in India, in Africa. Your further novels, Shadow Lines, The Calcutta Chromosome, which was actually the first book I read of yours many years ago. And it was very interesting because I studied science before literature. And so I was doing genetics, and that's when this book came into my hands, and I was very impressed. It was brilliant. The Glass Palace, which was actually the first book that many people became familiar with your name, was set in Burma, India, Malaysia. The Hungry Tide, in 2004, was set mainly in Calcutta. Lots of different places. I mean, this is the trend that we can see already, even before these three books have come into play. You've also done some non-fiction works and collections of essays, perhaps essays taken from the Granta and from the New Yorker,
yes.
And all of those. But they were sort of put into collections called Dancing in Cambodia and At Large in Burma, great title. The Imam and the Indian, which I've not read, but I must, it's on my list. And others, such as two of those. The Ibis Trilogy, and this is where I was going to show this wonderful video, all about the Ibis Trilogy. It's a work of historical fiction, 1,600 pages, I'm told, roughly, give or take, depending on who's published it. But over 10 years time to write it. The three books that make up the Ibis Trilogy, The Sea of Poppies, which came out in 2008, which was shortlisted for the Man Booker. River of Smoke came out in 2011, which was shortlisted for the Man Asia Prize. And now, the most anticipated book of this year from any South Asian writer, I have to say, is Flood of Fire, the final part of this trilogy, which I do hope will win a major award. The books are set in the first half of the 19th century. Two major historical phenomena act as a backdrop to this plot, the entire plot of the Ibis Trilogy. The Great Experiment, which involved the transport of indentured labour from India to work in the sugar plantations in other parts of the world, Mauritius. And the trade of opium between India and China. And the British, in particular the East India Company, who I think is a sponsor tonight. So you can blame them. The British played a significant part in both of these things. Ibis, the name of the ship, on board of the ship are the main characters that feature in this trilogy. Ibis starts its journey from Calcutta, carrying indentured servants and convicts destined for Mauritius, but runs into a storm and faces a mutiny. Two other ships are caught in the same storm, the Anahita, a vessel carrying opium to Canton, and the Red Ruth, which is a botanical expedition, also going to Canton. While some of the passengers of the Ibis reach their destination in Mauritius, others find themselves in Hong Kong and Canton and get caught up in events that lead to the first Opium War, which was starting in 1839. Now, for many of us, including me, this part of history is really not taught. We know nothing about it. I know we're here to discuss the books, but actually, the research you've done about this part of this period of time in world history, it would be great for you to share. How did this come about? What is the setting of this aspect of history?
Certainly. I'm happy to talk about that. First of all, let me excuse myself for being all bundled up, but I think I'm getting a sore throat, so I'm trying to protect myself probably vainly. Well, you know, for me, the Ibis Trilogy really began as a book about departures, you know. And I suppose it's partly because I myself have been traveling away from India so very often, but I became very interested in this whole question of how was it that Indians first began to leave India, because, you know, it's a curious thing that today the Indian diaspora, the Chinese diaspora are the two largest diasporas in the world, really. But actually, the Indian and Chinese diasporas are quite recent. They really date back only to the early 19th century. Whereas if you think of the European diasporas, you know, they go back many, many centuries, you know. Similarly, when you think of, the Arab dispersal, that again is something which happens millennia or more ago. So I became very interested in this question of how did it happen? How did it originally start? How did people like you and me end up, in different parts of the world and so many of us here? How was this process set in motion? And I became interested particularly when I was writing The Glass Palace in the whole history of indenture, you know. So I had, a book always starts with people and characters, and I had these ideas for a couple of characters, especially Deepthi, who's a central character in Sea of Poppies. She was a very strong character for me right from the start. And when I started writing Sea of Poppies, I tried to think of the background, I tried to imagine the background, from which such a person might enter the indenture. And that was when, you know, looking into the sort of factors of, you know, what existed here, what was happening then that sent so many people you know, millions of people just flooding away. Because if you think about it, one of the strangest things about the Indian indenture is that, you know, when you look at diasporas elsewhere, when you think of, say, England or France or something, in England, so many of the English who left, who went to America, for instance, or Australia, they're from Cornwall and Devon and other coastal areas, you know, and that's the same in France, you know. A lot of the people who left were from Normandy or Brittany and so on. But in India, the diaspora starts in the deep interior, you know, in this Bhojpuri-speaking region, around Patna, Ghazipur. And this became a strange question to me, because usually diasporas should start along the coasts. You know, it's from the coasts that you would expect people to leave. So why was it suddenly that, you know, in the early 19th century, suddenly these millions of people get up and, you know, set off across the sea, which is an unknown element to them. And actually, they were terrified of the sea. They used to call the sea the Kalapani, you know, which is the black water. So there was a real fear, you know, of the sea, of crossing the sea. So when I started researching the background, the thing that really jumped out was that this was exactly the area where the British, from the late 18th century onwards, were expanding opium production. You know, this Bhojpur region essentially was the area between Patna and Banaras. This became the area where the British were massively sort of expanding opium production. Because, you know, they faced a balance of payments problem with China. Tea had become a huge commodity in Britain. But the Chinese would only accept silver, and Britain was running out of silver. So the leaders of the East India Company actually sat down in Calcutta and thought of this devilish scheme. They said, oh, well, we must get the Chinese addicted to opium. I mean, really, it was like that. And so first, they sent off a few crates. And if you look at the graph of how the opium production expands in India, it's astonishing. It's like this. You know, so by 1839, China is actually facing this tsunami of opium, you know, coming towards it. But again, as I said, you know, when you expand the cultivation of, when you create a certain kind of monoculture, obviously it massively disrupts sort of local life and so on, you know. So I think that was a part of what was happening there, that, you know, opium production and the displacement of people sort of went hand in hand. You know, we know, for example, that in 1857, during the Great Mutiny, the cultivation of opium was one of the principal articulated grievances, you know, of the mutineers. So, you know, that was really how my interest in this field, in this entire sort of history started. And once I got into it, really, it became clear to me that almost everything I knew about Indian history was really not so closely related to the reality of people's lives. You know, it was something else that we were learning.
So the history books of India were not correct, were not accurate, were different, or were parts of history just taken out?
I certainly think, I mean, you know, you mentioned how you did not know about the Opium Wars, and really, you know, in Britain at least there's some sort of acknowledgement of it. In India, there's none. I mean, it was just a completely erased chapter, you know, in our history.
Yeah, the British Empire is always, surprisingly, the British Empire is always sort of seen as this highly moral, highly...
I don't know that I would see it as that.
That's certainly how it's taught. But really speaking, it was based on slaves and drugs. I mean, really,
yeah.
The whole empire.
That's right.
And so that aspect of it is not taught in the history books in this country. Do you think that Britain's tried to sort of, I mean, you're not from here, I mean, I can ask others this question, but I think that somewhere along the line, Britain has tried to erase this part and sort of forget about it, or not take responsibility for their part in making all of this happen, which is...
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's absolutely the case. I mean, that's why this history is completely effaced. But, you know, for me, as an Indian, what's actually really interesting is why it's effaced in India, you know? Because this was essentially an Indian war. It was financed by Parsi merchants from Bombay. It was fought by Indian troops. It was planned in India. And India was one of the beneficiaries. You know, Indian merchants were among the beneficiaries.
Yeah.
the reality is that, you know, any old money in India, especially old capital, came from opium. You know, some of the most important Indian conglomerates today actually had their beginning in the opium trade.
Any that you can say publicly?
Well, one owns a very famous British motoring company.
Say no more. Your books have been obviously very well received amongst the literary community, amongst the readers, but also amongst the sort of amongst historians, because you've written about aspects of history that no one else has written about. Are you a historian? Are you the William Dalrymple of Bengal?
Good God! I hope not.
You don't have to answer that part.
No,
are you a historian? Let's go back.
That. If that's your idea of a historian.
Do you regard yourself as a historian or an academic?
No, I don't.
Or an anthropologist, because you studied that?
No, not at all. You know, I studied anthropology, and that was fun to do. But, you know, that was a part of my life, but, you know, for a very brief time.
So you were a writer?
Yes, I'm a novelist.
Absolutely. Some of the characters in the trilogy, which is fascinating, you have Bihari peasants, you have Velasca sailors, you have Bengali zamindars, landowners, you have the Parsi businessmen that you just mentioned. You have the boat people from Canton, you have the British traders and the officials. You even have a Cornish botanist.
Yes.
And you also have a French sort of person who was looking for exotic flowers, I think in one of the characters. Where do you get inspiration for these characters? Where have you met these people? Have you read about these people? Where did these ideas come from?
Oh, sorry. Yes, I mean, some, you know, the way that characters emerge is never simple. You know, sometimes characters come straight out of your imagination. Sometimes they have more complicated genealogies. You know, sometimes you just meet people and then a little bit of them stays in your head and you put it together and, you know, they slowly grow from a nucleus.
And as a bit of a teaser to those who haven't yet, nobody here has read the final book. Which of the characters have carried on through into the Aditi's there? I
yes, Aditi's been a constant, absolutely.
Yeah. And the rest you can just read and find out yourself. One of the other things in the first two books that I've read, I found fascinating was the use of language. And when I go to literary festivals in India, Jaipur or Calcutta or others like that, which I've had the privilege of being at, and I hear panelists talk, and they're talking in English, but every now and then they'll throw in the odd Hindi word or the old Bhojpuri word or something, Urdu word. And I always feel for the non-Asians sitting there, and I wonder, will they understand what's being said? Can they get a sense of it? But they do, because they see it in a wider context. And similarly with South Asian literature, increasingly now, so much English and so much other things are going into these books. And you very openly used vocabulary, words from all these different languages, Malay and Hindi and so forth, and also dialects as well. How when you're writing, is that something you're conscious of, or is that something that just flows naturally? You just think, well, this is the character, this is what they would say, and that's why these words are there.
You know, I think that's really, for me, one of the problems is where do you decide that it's Malay or English, for example? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, if you, many South Asian writers, I see them, I see them, let's say, italicizing certain words. You know, they'll italicize a word like masjid, for example, meaning mosque. But the word masjid is in the Oxford English Dictionary. So if you're italicizing that, what do you do about something like, say, seersucker, you know, which is also from Hindustani, or, you know, calico, or, you know, muslin? There are so many words. I mean, or admiral. What do? You italicize admiral because it's from Arabic? So, you know, that's a kind of infinite regress. I don't even know how you would draw these lines. I mean, like, you're saying that I'm using words from Hindustani, for example. But actually, all those words are in the longer Oxford English Dictionary.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so when people say to me, your books don't have a glossary, I say, you know, actually they do. It's the longer Oxford English Dictionary. So just look it up, just Google this word, you'll see. It'll take you straight to the Oxford English Dictionary. So, you know, what is actually the case is that 19th century English was very, very subtle and especially very absorptive of influences of many, many different kinds from many different places. You know, 19th century English was in many ways, I would say, more cosmopolitan than contemporary English, because, you know, the great dictionary projects actually had the effect of freezing vocabulary, you know, whereas vocabularies were much, much more dynamic, you know, in the 18th and 19th centuries. And that's a very striking thing about 18th and 19th century English, that it was able to absorb so many different words. And it wasn't just English. I mean, so much of you know, ordinary usage in Hindustani comes from, say, Portuguese, you know. Say, for example, a word that we use very commonly in India, balti. All of you know what balti means. It means bucket. But it actually comes from Portuguese, you know, and it came through a nautical language because it originally meant ship's bucket. You know, it was a bucket that was used on a ship. So there are all these words that, you know, so there's this enormous sort of linguistic exchange going on.
Yeah.
There's exchanges of many different kinds going on. There's a musical exchange, there's an enormous botanical exchange, which I write about at great length in River of Smoke. So, you know, this is a very fecund moment in many ways. And, you know, it's easy to sort of think, looking back on it now, that it was the West exporting stuff. But it was very much also the other way around. So you do see this kind of intricate sort of interweaving.
Do you speak other languages other than Hindi, Bengali,
yes.
English?
Yes, of course. I learned Arabic, and I speak some French. So yes, I have several languages, yes.
Fantastic. We'll carry on talking about Ibis, but let's just go back a little bit, some of the other books you've written. Shadow Lines. Is often regarded as a sort of critique of nationalism and cultural borders, geographical borders, that kind of thing. And you know, you seem to sort of advocate universal humanity. People have sort of compared you with Edward Said, with Gandhi. Are you a Gandhian? just on the side.
You know. How can I say that I'm a Gandhian? I'm not a vegetarian. You know, so I certainly read Gandhi with the deepest attention. Gandhi's thought was a powerful influence in my work and in my life. But I would never presume to say that I'm a Gandhian. I think if you are calling yourself a Gandhian, you have to go through certain sorts of, you have to jump through certain hoops, you know, and I'm not going to jump through those hoops.
When you're compared to people like Edward Said, with Herman Melville, Joseph Conrad. How does that make you feel? I mean, do you feel... How does that make you feel?
You're just suggesting these astonishing comparisons to me.
And I'm not making them.
I mean,
these are things I've read, these are things that I've heard, these are things which are there in the public view.
What, somebody's compared me to Edward Said?
Absolutely.
Can someone
tweet that? Can someone please tweet that right now? I'm so good, just found out who's compared to it.
I'm really very, very, very surprised to hear that. You know, in what way could my work be like Edward Said's? Edward Said was a sort of, you know, he was a systematic philosopher, really. He was building a sort of system of ideas. And that is exactly what I am not, you know. That's why I'm not a historian, I'm not an anthropologist. Because I'm not a person who thinks in abstractions. You know, I think in very concrete ways. I think about people. I think about the sort of plights that various characters face. That's what interests me. I'm just not a person who's that interested in abstract ideas, you know. So, of course, I've read Said. I knew Said. You know, what he's doing and what I'm doing, I would say have very little relation to each other. I mean, of course, I have the greatest respect for his work and for his thought.
Right. You've already shared that you've been travelling to all different places. You are a sort of wanderer. Where have you been in the last 1 year? And what's been your favourite place?
This last 1 year, I travelled really a great, great deal. The most amazing thing I did was I sailed in a Bugis sail ship. The Bugis are an ancient seafaring people of the Indian Ocean. They're basically sort of based around Sulawesi in Indonesia. And they build these marvelous schooners, you know, sail ships. So I sailed in a Bugis ship in the Flores Sea. So I went to the Komodo Islands and, in that area. And I must say, it was just the most magical, most marvelous journey, one of the most marvelous journeys of my life. Because not only seeing the Komodo dragons and being on this ship with these wonderful sailors, you know, they were such wonderful people, good-hearted, friendly, raucous, they would sing, and but also, the marine life in that area is so amazing. I mean, I remember a day when, we were snorkeling, and this huge sort of group of manta rays appeared, gigantic 9-foot animals. And, they were making eye contact. They were playing with us. They were sort of going around us, and I've just never seen anything like it. I mean, when an animal makes eye contact with you, it establishes its own intelligence, and you could see these animals were literally playing with us. It was completely marvelous. I'll never forget it, really. It's
amazing. Travel features a lot in your prose, but also so does food.
Yes.
Immense amount of food in all of these, but are you a foodie?
I would call myself a foodie in the modern sense of, liking exquisite creations in restaurants and that kind of thing. But I love food. I love to cook, but I love to cook because I love being around people. I love feeding people. I love feeding people. I love having people around my table. I just enjoy that. And I cook for my family all the years that my children were growing up. Not that they like my cooking so much, but they prefer pizza. But, I love food, and I also like growing food. I grow a lot of stuff now in my house in Goa. I grow the best pepper you'll ever taste, black pepper. And it's nothing like the commercial product. So, I really enjoy growing spices, I enjoy growing food, and I like doing things with, food from my garden, stuff that's
available.
That's
the next book, Amitav Ghosh's Home Cooked Recipes.
No. I don't think I would ever want to do that. That's what's very special about that for me, is that food is, in a sense, about love and conviviality. And I wouldn't want that to become, as it were, a part of a public sphere, That's just not what it's for me.
Sure. Something I've always wondered, I'm sure others in the audience will also, is when you read these books, you can actually visualize it, you can see it. You almost think this is going to be made into a film. Has anyone ever talked about adaptations? Have you ever thought about adaptations? Is that something we can expect, perhaps in the future?
Sea of Poppies has been optioned, and many filmmakers have spoken to me about it. It's not currently under option, but it has been. Many filmmakers have talked to me about it.
Any reservation?
No, I have no reservations. But, at this point, I think anyone who set out to make a film of Sea of Poppies would have to take on the whole trilogy.
Yeah.
Because it's impossible now to sort of cut one book off from the other. And,
And is this a sort of Eskin approach come from the West or from the Indian films?
From both, actually. Yes. So I don't know if it'll ever, if anything will ever come of it, but certainly I'm not interested in adapting them. I feel I have too many things to write. I don't want to get involved with, a new medium, one which I probably won't be any good at.
Well, I think certainly we hope that those of us who have read the books and will read all three do hope that one day other audiences, film audiences, can also get to enjoy and see and understand and learn from what these books can offer. Some of the serious issues that do come across in your trilogy, I'd like to just maybe go through a few of them. We talked about immigration. The books trace the histories of immigrants pulled and pushed across the various borders, sometimes very blurred borders that exist in this part of Asia, due to exploitation, greed, adventure, all of these sorts of things. Some of these problems exist even today. People move around. Sometimes they go with their own will. Sometimes they are forced to go. When you see the news and when you see of the what's happening with the migrants coming from North Africa to Europe, or when you see of the migrants going from Bengal, Bangladesh, towards the Far East, what is that? Do you have any thoughts on it? Does it make you feel that, why is this happening even today?
I think it's perfectly clear why it's happening. Really, one of the major factors in it is climate change. If you look at where these migrants are coming from, it's almost always from climate distressed areas, from the Sahel, from Darfur, from Western Africa, Syria, as we know now. The 2008 drought in Syria was a major factor in starting the civil war. And I think what really alarms me is that, you know, when you read these accounts in the press, there's never any mention of the broader drivers of these impacts. You know, certainly, you know, Bangladesh is now really facing a circumstance where, you know, 1 meter of sea level rise in Bangladesh is going to swamp something like half the country. You know, and I'm from Bengal. I know how vulnerable this place is. I've written about the Sundarbans, and I've seen entire villages in the Sundarbans disappear in front of my eyes. In the Sundarbans today, you know, there's such an intense encroachment of salinity. You know, lands that were once fertile are now just being gobbled up by the sea. Nobody who pays attention to what is happening on the South Asian subcontinent can be in any doubt about how incredibly vulnerable, South Asia is. And yet, even in South Asia, you know, people just don't seem to pay any attention, you know, to these broader impacts. And I just don't know how one accounts for it, you know. I just don't know how one accounts for the complete obliviousness that people have to what's happening. If the world had any kind of sanity in it, what international groups would do would be to put together some sort of plan for the future for Bangladesh. Because it's clear, you know, that a large part of this country is going to disappear. This is one of the most thickly populated parts of the globe, you know. Where are those people going to go?
Yeah.
And we know that already we are beginning to see the impacts of, climate-driven migration pushing into Burma, pushing into India. But yet, you know, there is something sort of in our contemporary mindset which always prompts us to interpret every problem as a political problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and of course they take on political dimensions. I mean, there's no denying that. But behind those political dimensions, there are these broader problems. And, you know, frankly, let's face it, these problems are not soluble. You know, this is not going to get better. It's going to get worse. Much, much worse. Because I don't think the Syria conflict is soluble. That's not to say that incredibly bad foreign policy decisions started this conflict. But at the same time, now it's in a circumstance where I just don't see how it's going to be brought under control.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, you know, I lived in Egypt. I even studied Egypt academically, you know, so I have some background in that. When I was in Egypt in 1980-81, Egypt was a country of 42 million people, you know. Now Egypt is a country of almost of 95 million people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all the people along that narrow strip. And of course, if we had an ideal circumstance where water could be distributed completely, with absolute equality for everyone, perhaps we could address this problem. But the fact is, we don't have an ideal situation anywhere in the world, even in California, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we are facing this incredible catastrophe, and I just find it astonishing that, you know, this dimension of it is really never mentioned. I mean, if the European Union had any foresight, really, what they would try to do is to invest in the Maghrib, you know, mm. to try and create, you know, employment opportunities there.
You mentioned Bangladesh, and something else that you were in the news about recently was that yourself and Salman Rushdie and Margaret Atwood and Poets of Mystery, Neil Mukherjee, so many writers signed a letter, wrote a letter to the Bangladeshi government, pleading them to punish the killers of the bloggers, the three bloggers. So freedom of expression is something which is still a problem in South Asia. Do you think it will get better? Do you think sending a letter, I mean, it's a great thing to do, and it the awareness of it was great in all the press and media. But do you think it will make a difference? Do you think this issue will get any better?
You know, I think to put this thing in perspective, the first thing to be said is that Bangladesh is a country which has somehow, despite all the difficulties, clung on to a certain kind of secularist tradition. Mm-hmm. You know, that's why you have the secular bloggers. Mm-hmm. Because a very large percentage of the Bangladeshi population is actually opposed to a religious rule, you know. And I think this is something we must always acknowledge when we speak of Bangladesh, and we must, as it were, congratulate them for it, because this is a wonderful thing that they've clung on to, you know, despite all the odds. But again, that's what it is. I mean, it's fiercely embattled, you know. The whole sort of secular tradition in Bangladesh is fiercely embattled, and that's exactly what this circumstance represents. Yeah. You know, all the sort of secularist groups are coming under intense pressure in Bangladesh, and it's in some ways it's almost a sort of all-out war between them. But you asked me if I think freedom of expression is going to get better.
It's across the whole of the region, not just in Bangladesh.
Not just the whole region, anywhere in the world. Look, in the 20th century, we conceptualized freedom of expression problems as essentially state-citizen problems, you know, state-civil society problems. But it's no longer, that is no longer the problem. In very few places, is it the state that's going out of its way to create problems for writers or artists? What it has become is that it's non-state actors, you know. And let's say, first of all, you know, various forms of religious fundamentalists, you know, whether it be Hindu or Buddhist or Muslim or whatever, but also corporations. I mean, don't forget the enormous part that corporations are now playing in the suppression of free speech, you know. And I think that's something that we don't pay enough attention to. You know, the way that McDonald's went after people who were complaining, the ways in which say the big petroleum corporations go after scientists, so that's it, you know? Mm-hmm. The sorts of attacks that scientists must, you know, climate scientists regularly face. So, and quite apart from that, the fact that there's been such a sort of conglomeratization of publishing, you know, that in itself is a form of constraint over expression. Right. So we are seeing, certainly I would say, that despite the many freedoms that the internet has brought and so on, we are seeing a sort of constraint occurring across the field.
Have you ever felt that your work has been, that you felt constrained in writing something?
Look, for me, I find it very difficult to answer that, because the reality is that I think all writing is done under circumstances of constraint. Mm. You know, and the constraint is often, if there weren't constraints, you would just be babbling. You know, I mean, that's the difference. I mean, you know, I often feel like saying to people, you know, free speech doesn't mean endless speech. And really, that's what you often see on the internet. Everyone thinks that they have to have an opinion about everything all the time. You know, so I think that if you give any thought to anything, first, you have to pick your battles. Secondly, you have to you can't be babbling about everything all the time, and you have to decide, you know, where is the core of your expressive freedom, you know, and you have to and that's a strategic thing, you know, it always is. I mean, all expression occurs, you know, under those circumstances.
How do you write? What's your style of what's your method of writing? How do you decide that I'm going to sit, I'm going to write this? You know, do you go into a poem line in the corner somewhere and no one calls you for 10 years? How do you do it?
Yeah, I've never done anything other than write. And it's a strange thing to say, because I feel that by temperament I'm a very indisciplined person. But simply because I've done this all my life now, it has become a form of, it's the only thing I know how to do. So, you know, by like 8:30 in the morning, I'm at my desk, I'm sitting there, you know, by 10 o'clock, I've cleared my desk, and after that, I write.
Do you listen to music while you're writing?
No, never. No. I love music, but music would distract me. You know, a dog barking far away distracts me. I'm very easily distracted. I'm distracted by birds, by so no. I really need situations. You know, the most difficult moment in the day is really that moment at about 8:30 or 9 in the morning, when you're trying tentatively to make your way to your desk. And at that moment, if there's a sudden phone call, and you find yourself talking for 10 minutes, that's the end of your day. You know, those wisps of concentration in your mind are just blown apart like that, and your whole day is over. You know, so it's such a strange thing. I mean, there is that moment when you're just trying to still your mind, you know. I think writing is a deeply meditative practice. You know, it's in some ways really like meditation, because say, for example, writing these three books. You know, these books are long books about a single chapter in history. So I felt like I was traveling the opposite direction from the modern world, because everybody now has such short attention spans. And I was just, you know, in this long, long attention span. And, you know, at a certain point, I even began to think, I mean, I'm writing all this, but will readers retain the skills to read, you know, in these long attention spans? And I don't know the answer to that, you know, I really wonder.
So, with the traffic of Brooklyn, traffic of Calcutta, which is even worse sometimes, and all the tourism and holiday makers that go up, which is the place where you find, where is it easiest for you to write?
Brooklyn is very quiet. It's not at all like Manhattan. Brooklyn is very, very quiet and sylvan and peaceful. And, you know, before the hipsters took it over, it used to be even more so. But now it's become sort of a very rapidly gentrifying place, so there's a lot of construction noise, and that really throws me. Yeah, it does. But otherwise, Brooklyn is very quiet and very peaceful. Well,
so is North London. It's very quiet.
I
recommend it highly.
But in Goa, I live in a very rural part of Goa, so it's only birds and dogs that disturb me.
I think we can open up for questions. How long have we got, approximately? About half an hour, brilliant. I have got tons more questions, and I could go on, but I can see many of you are nodding and kind of getting excited. Can I just, a show of hands, how many of you would like to ask questions? One?
Yes.
Great, please do start us off.
I just wanted to ask you about the mic.
Oh, hold on a second, so we have a mic. Just so that others can also hear the question, that's the only thing.
You touched a bit on the language in the books and the fact that people talk in dialect, really, one would say. And I wondered about the research. You said it was in the longer English dictionary, but Oxford Music Dictionary. But did you have to do masses of research on those the speech of the characters?
Yes, I did. I did a lot of research. You know, we don't actually know how English people in the early 19th century spoke in India, you know. But we do know that they did not speak standard English, you know, because when they came back to England, they stood out for their speech, you know. And if we compare it with, say, for example, Dutch settlers in Java, they would lose their language. I mean, Dutch would become a second language to them within one generation. I don't think that exactly happened to English people in India, but it is a fact that, you know, a lot of English people grew up in India with Hindustani as their first language, because, you know, they were brought up by ayahs and so on, and they spoke to them in Hindustani. We know that Rudyard Kipling, for example, didn't learn English till he was like six,
wow.
You know. So clearly there was a lot of Indian vocabulary of various different kinds in English speech in India. What exactly it sounded like, I don't think we can tell, because of course we don't have recordings, so I had to make that up. But as to the vocabulary, you know, we have many guides, you know, into the vocabulary. There are many of these dictionaries of slang and cant and so on, which are very interesting, as windows upon language. There's also a wonderful dictionary called Hobbs and Jobson, you know, which has of colonial English. But there are many others actually like Hobson Jobson. So you know, one does get a certain. It's possible to sort of do research in this and find a language that was sort of spoken at about that time. But you know, what actually really interested me is that when I started writing this trilogy, one thing I wanted to suggest is the sort of multiplicity of the Indian Ocean region. You know, because there are so many languages spoken in this region. I think anybody who was venturing into it would be partly bewildered by the languages that were, that were manifesting themselves all around them. So, you know, of course, you can't do that by actually using other languages. But I wanted to suggest this multiplicity by using dialects of English, Mem Sahib dialect, if you like, on the one hand, but also nautical speech and pidgin English. And our own Indian English, which was wonderfully colorful and, as you know, still exists today in many different forms. So I wanted to use all these resources and to put them, to deploy them, if you like, within this trilogy.
Thank you. I think it works brilliantly.
Thank you. Thank you.
Can I ask a question? When you came to the end of writing Pot of Fire, I mean, when you came right towards the end of it, was there a level of sadness that this is now the end of this great canon of work which you've spent more than 10 years on? And once it was sent and once it was printed, did you feel, oh, I forgot to put something in there?
You know, I really expected that, because I've felt that sadness, that sort of postpartum thing that you have when you finish a book. I felt it with all my other books. But I have to say, I didn't feel it with this one. You know, when I got to the end of it, I felt rather this incredible sense of fulfillment. You know, I just felt that I set myself this task, this really, really... Oh, I'm sorry. I set myself something that was really, really difficult to do. And, you know, there were many, many times when I was writing these books when I thought I was crazy to take this on. And you can see why really people, most novelists write short books. You can really see, because a long book, it's not twice as hard, it's exponentially harder, you know. And I know, because I've also written short books. So it seemed, it was an incredible sort of, it was an incredible odyssey, and at the end of it, I just felt this amazing sense of fulfillment. You know, I felt that I'd lived with this thing and that I'd managed to bring it together in exactly the way I wanted, you know. And really, it was often just like, it often just threatened to just fall to the floor, you know, and scatter in 1,000 different pieces. So just to be able to keep it together. In Bengali, you know, when we speak of making a story, we say, you made the story stand, you know. And it was really like that. You know, often when I write, I think of that metaphor of making something stand, you know. And it stood, you know, and it held up its own weight.
Fantastic. Any more questions? Yes, there's a mic. Just at the third row here.
By the way, have we had any luck with the video?
We think so.
Oh,
you just need to swap the laptops around.
Okay, do you want to
do that while I'm doing the question?
Yeah, let's do that.
You've just mentioned Bengali. I'm Bengali myself. So, have you got any plans? Have you ever written in Bengali? Or would you like to write in Bengali? That is one. And the other thing is, have you drawn any inspiration from Bengali literature, which is a rich one?
Yes, I mean, when I was a child, I would write letters to my parents in Bengali, and I've read a lot of Bengali. I still read Bengali all the time, really. And Bengali is a very, very important part of my mental makeup. You know, I mean, the sort of relationship that there is between Bengali and English in my head is really what the territory of this book covers. You know. So yes, Bengali is a very, very important part of my life, and I found it invaluable even in the writing of these books, you know, because one of the central characters in this book, in Flood of Fire is actually a soldier. You know, and you know, it's an astonishing thing that between 1760 and 1914, you know, millions of Indians served as soldiers in the British, in various British armies. Yet, there's only one memoir written by a soldier, and it wasn't even written by him. It was actually apocryphal, you know. And so, you know, when I started looking for material on which to base, you know, my idea of what a soldier's life was like in the 19th century, eventually I had to fall back on later stuff written post-First World War. And Shantanu Das, who's here, who's written, who's the great scholar of India in the First World War, he led me to these two wonderful Bengali autobiographies. Well, one is an autobiography and one is a sort of it's a set of letters written by two Bengalis. You know, they were medical personnel, they were not soldiers. But I think these two books are really among the great classics of First World War literature. But they were unknown even in Bengal. They were self-published. They had completely vanished from public memory. But we are trying hard to restore them to the to the place they deserve.
Such wonderful, vibrant characters, and I find myself desperate to sort of, you know, find out what happens to them. And my question to you is about their your process. History provides a framework, but when you sit down to write, do you know the fate of each of these individual characters? Do you sort of outline it, or does it sort of come to you as you're writing?
Well, the short answer to that is no. I don't have any idea of the fate of the characters. And that's because in some, I know it sounds weird to say it, but in some essential way, you know, characters do make their own fates, you know, and you don't know the fates at the beginning. It's in the process of writing that you discover what they're going to do. You know, it doesn't, at least I can't sit down with a sort of plan and then make them walk along those roads, you know, because they really do develop minds of their own. Writing about a character is really like getting to know a friend, you know. You get to know them, you know, over months and weeks and years. And it's always as it is with a friend. I mean, you find that, you know, you think you know them, but you don't really know them. You know, they always do things that you don't expect. They always surprise you. They do, they wander in different directions. Thank you.
Any more questions? It's one at the front over here.
There's one over here.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, how was the River of Smoke received in Hong Kong and China? Because they've got, I've spoken to a lot of Chinese people, they've got a long history of the Opium Wars. It's very, they still know about it quite well, whilst in the West and India they've quite forgotten about it. How is that received, and how do you think it's affecting the politics of China at the moment?
Well, all three books, I mean, the first two have already been translated in into Mandarin. That is, you know, simplified Chinese. The Sea of Poppies is coming out in Taiwan later this year. You know, I think Chinese readers have read them with great interest. As far as I know, they've had a they've had a good reception. And as you say, the Opium Wars are very, very alive in Chinese memory. I mean, just in Guangdong province, there are so many museums and you know, basically dedicated to the Opium Wars. So for China, this is a very, very important phase, a chapter in history. And actually, if you think about it, the First Opium War was really a critical moment in world history. Because, you know, just as we were always taught that the French Revolution was a critical moment in the making of modernity, you know, if you look at history from a non-Eurocentric perspective, the Opium War is a similar moment. Because that is what gives us the Asia that we know today, you know. And in as much as Asia, the Asia as we know it today is a major player in the world, it was the First Opium War that created it.
Thank you. you know, I mean, you talked earlier about the movement of people because of climate change and things like that, where they you know, that happens. But there's also a certain type of movement of people where it's not out of choice, it's not because of the climate, it's because they've physically been taken from one place and put into another. And that sort of human trafficking that is happening, which is so prevalent all over the world, but actually in particular in Asia, in South Asia. Why, you know, in Calcutta is your hometown, and you've written about Calcutta so wonderfully and so beautifully, but it's the one place where I felt, where I saw the sex slave industry in its peak, really, when I visited there a few years ago. And these sorts of issues that happen in this part of the world, do you think that that is something that can change? Climate, we have little control. Well, there's a long-term plan. But here, is there something that we can, that a short-term plan can actually make a difference?
You know, again, I would say that even if you look at, say, the sex workers industry in Calcutta, you'll find that a lot of them are actually displaced people from the Sundarbans. You know, the Sundarbans have actually become, you know, they've been so badly affected that over the last 10 years, there's been this huge sort of out-migration of young people. Mm. And a lot of stuff that I've read about the Calcutta sex industry make it perfectly clear that, in fact, you know, many sex workers in Calcutta are actually climate refugees. So yes, climate is there, inescapably in the background. Mm. And that is why I don't think that these issues offer simple solutions. I think more government government policing, more, obviously, you know, there's a lot that could be done in that direction. But I hate to sound pessimistic, but I think looking ahead, we're looking at great upheavals of population which are not going to be easily addressed. And not only that, I don't even see that it's beginning to be addressed. You know, I mean, it just strikes me as so bizarre that, you know, America is lecturing Indonesia and Malaysia on taking in Rohingya refugees. Whereas, you know, anywhere you go in Asia, it's fairly thickly populated. Why don't they take them in? You know, Australia, so much of Australia is, you know, so sparsely populated. Why don't they take in more refugees? I mean, you know, in Australia, you remember those terrible protests where people started sewing their lips together and so on. I mean, really, I just find it so inappropriate that they would lecture, you know, Indonesia and Malaysia, because all Asian countries have taken in enormous numbers of migrants. India has, you know, and inadvertently or not, it's true of, you know, in Malaysia as well, there are enormous numbers of migrant workers. Mm. So, I don't see that it's going to be a problem that's very easily addressed. Or...
Any more questions from the audience?
Yes.
Yes.
Just
wait a second.
I just wondered, after 10 years of writing and 3 books later, do you ever go back to the beginning and read your books just to enjoy them?
You know, after I finished Sea of Poppies, all these 3 books, I often found myself, you know, going back, reading chapters, reading parts of the books. I mean, you do it almost nostalgically, you know, thinking, oh my God, I actually did this. You know, it just seems so incredible. But do I ever read them through from beginning to end? No. No, that would be traumatic.
What do your family think of you? What do your children think of your books?
My children grew up with the books. You know, I mean, they were not even teenagers when I started writing this trilogy, and now they're both out of college. So they really grew up with it, and you know, I think it's sort of in the background. I mean, you know, just like, you know, dad could be an accountant, it's like dad's a writer out there.
And final question from my side is what next?
Well, you know, these 10 years that I've been focusing on these books, I've had to put everything else aside. And there are so many ideas just fizzing in my head. And that's one of the reasons why I didn't feel at all melancholic after I finished the book, because I'm actually finishing. I had to finish another, this set of lectures, which is going to be published as a book. I have to do that by September. Then I have another nonfiction book that I'm going to finish by next March. So I just have, you know, I just have so much to do that I've not had any time to catch my breath.
Well, that's fantastic news, because the more you write, the more you'll enjoy and continue to read your work. I think we've got a video.
We have got a video, I know, bear with us. Yeah.
Brilliant. So shall we quickly watch that?
We can watch the video. I might have to separate you away from the stream.
Sure.
And also, just to let everyone know that I'm really pleased, because Amitabh is going to sign copies of the books for us. So
okay.
we'll be
so shall I wrap
now.
Up and then...
Go on, you wrap up and then
we
can...
I was going to try and do it the other way, but okay. So, I'll wrap up. It's been an immense pleasure. When Jemima invited me to interview you for this event, I was sort of jumping up and down with excitement. Great. The book is fantastic. I'm about a third of the way through it. I'm sorry I couldn't finish it all in time for today. It's fantastic.
Thank you.
And meeting you, talking to you, has been a great pleasure for me. And I think hopefully the audience will agree we've learned something about Amitabh Ghosh, which we didn't know before an hour ago. So big thank you to you. Big thank you to Asia House, to Jemima, and all the trustees of Asia House, and of course the Vagri Foundation, Alka Vagri, and the family who are here, who have made this possible now for the second year.
Yeah.
And hopefully for more to come. When you said books that stand up, this wonderful image that they've created of this book that comes to life is just superb, and exactly what the festival's all about. So we wish you all good luck for next year. And thank you to all of you for coming. Thank you to Waterstones for hosting us. So nice. This is a great space. And thank you to the East India Company for doing all that damage. We do enjoy their teas and their chocolates and things like that and their biscuits. So we are now going to watch this video, but please join me in giving a big round of applause.
This is where it could go horribly wrong again, but we can try. We can try, can't we?
Oh, right. Where's my technical advisors? I think it was that chap there. Okay.
The Hungi is centered now, but was once one of the world's busiest ports. And Kolkata, or Calcutta as the city was then known, was the capital of Britain's empire in India and the hub of British military power in Asia. Calcutta is a point of departure for many of the voyages of the Ibis trilogy. The city was then, as it is now, a place of extreme contrasts. Some wealthy merchants built houses so opulent that Calcutta was known as the city of palaces in the 19th century. Poor and destitute also flocked to the city in great numbers to seek a meager living. During the years of the Raj, the British launched many wars, large and small, from Calcutta. My new novel, Flood of Fire, is about a war that has disappeared into the furthest recesses of memory in Britain and in India. The First Opium War of 1840 to 42, which was instrumental in shaping the world as we know it today. Of Calcutta's exports, the most important was opium. And the greatest beneficiary of the trade was Britain's East India Company. In Bengal, the company enjoyed a complete monopoly in the production and marketing of the drug, which it used to finance its enormously lucrative trade with China. The building in which the East India Company usually held its opium auctions was probably at this location.
The informal market in opium futures, where vast fortunes were made and unmade in a single day, was in a lane like this one.
The chief market for the East India Company's opium was China, which meant that a large fleet of ships shuttled constantly between Calcutta and Guangzhou, or Canton as it was known to Europeans. This connection brought many Chinese sailors, traders and artisans to Calcutta, and by the late 18th century there was a thriving Chinese quarter in the city. In today's Kolkata, the Chinese community has dwindled to a couple of thousand residents, yet traces of its past prosperity can still be seen in its temples and meeting places. A few members of this community figure in River of Smoke, the second book in the Ibis trilogy. We meet them again in Flood of Fire. The Ibis trilogy begins in the opium fields of Bihar and follows the migration of indentured workers to British colonies across the world. In this book, several characters from Sea of Poppies, Zachary Reed, a young American sailor, Neil Ratan Haldar, the former Raja of Ras Khali, and Jodhu, a young Muslim boatman, cross paths with Havildar Kesri Singh, who is one of the 4,000 soldiers who traveled to China to fight in the First Opium War. From the other end of the main deck, Kesri drank in the sights of the receding city, the temples, the houses, the trees, as if he were seeing them for the last time. As the city slipped past, a strange, cold feeling crept through him, and he realized with a shock that deep in his heart, he too had come to believe that he would never see his homeland again. One of the things I wanted to convey when I started writing the Ibis trilogy was an aspect of Indian life in which stories and shared histories and memories connect generations over periods of decades and centuries. That's been the texture of my life. Knitting together generations through their shared stories, the Ibis trilogy links the destinies of Calcutta and Guangzhou, India and China. A history of mutual destruction from which they are only now beginning to emerge.